Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Kevin, I am excited for today's guest. While audiences across America might remember her as Ted Knight's wife on Too Close for Comfort, or Alan Arkin's wife in one of my favorite films, The In-Laws,
of course,
it was on Broadway where Tony nominee Nancy Dessau first got her start.
In the golden age of the American musical theater, Nancy worked with everyone from Julie Stein to Stephen Sondheim, from Cheetah Rivera to Phil Silvers. She was the first person to introduce audiences to such standards as Make Someone Happy, Cry Like the Wind, and one of our personal favorites, the want song to end all want songs, Rob's favorite, Where Is the Tribe for Me?
I'll be playing it later.
That's right.
To tell us how she lost it to Mario Lanza, overcame the curse of Bajor, and how Liza Minnelli stole her Tony, here from Oxnard, California, is the two-time Tony nominee, Nancy Dessau. How did you discover musical theater living all the way down in Pensacola, Florida?
Well, I was born there. I was born on the Naval Station because my dad was, he got to the Naval Academy, he was in the Navy, but we never stayed there. I mean, I think I left when I was like 8 months old, and I had never returned. We lived back and forth. We never went overseas because my dad, during the war when he was overseas, was always on secret missions, so we never got to partake of that part. But it was, you know, I took my little piano lessons. I was mad for the piano, my little tap classes and stuff. But it wasn't until I got into high school. My father was stationed at the Pentagon, and we were living in Arlington, Virginia, and I went to a very big high school, Washington Lee High School, and got in the choir. The choir teacher, who was a graduate of Northwestern, and I knew we had a good choir because everyone wanted to be in it, and we traveled. We did concerts all over. But she came home from school with me one day and sat my family down, and including me, and said, "Do you know that Nancy sings?" And she said, "I mean, really sings. Do you know that?" You know, we all, including me, went, "No." She then I said, "If you can afford it, whatever, I would like to recommend a singing teacher." And so I started singing lessons. And I started doing little things around town. I started doing a local television show singing. And it was so funny because at that point, I was in love with Jane Froman. Remember Jane Froman?
Yes,
of course.
So my first song on television was I Believe. You remember that song?
Yeah, that was your first one?
That was my first one because I had a big old voice. And I kept doing this show, which was really good for me, but then I had to join the union, and my parents wouldn't let me join the union. And then I also sang with the band. But the same teacher, Florence Booker, who I do talk about in this act, she then, I was trying to get into Duke University where my sister went. But she said, "No, you're not. I want you to go to Northwestern." And she just picked up the phone and called them. Like in March or something before that fall, because I had been accepted at Duke, and they said take her, and they went okay. So that's how I got in college, and now I help kids get in college, and it's so hard. I can't believe what they have to go through.
It's rigorous. Oh my gosh. Were your parents supportive of you pursuing this career?
No, not at all. But they, you know, they were thrilled that I got in this good school, and I was in the music department. I think if I tried to get in another school at Northwestern, I might not have been able to get in, but because of her persuasion. And you know, then later I found out she was considered one of the leading music teachers in the country. She was, you know, the top 10.
Oh, wow.
So her word did mean something, and, you know, off I went. And that was probably the luckiest break of my life, besides her telling me that I could do this. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't grow up doing shows in my garage and
yeah.
dinner for my parents, and I had no thought of going into the field or ambitions. I like to sing.
Right.
And my sister told me recently, she said, Jesus, you sang all the time around that. You drove me crazy. And I don't even remember that. I don't remember that. I do know I used to make up songs when I was little and do all that, but it was not my world, you know.
Who are your favorite singers?
I didn't even have any till I was
really
in high school, you know. And then I guess I saw Jane Froman on television, I had only heard one show album, which was Kismet. My sister brought me that.
Nice.
And then I started liking from the radio Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I loved all those ladies in the movies. I mean, you know, I loved Deanna Durbin and Judy Garland and all those ladies. And then I fell in love with Mario Lanza. And I tell this story where we had one of those big radios that sat on the floor, you know, big oval-shaped radios, and the speakers were strips down the front of the radio. And I used to get a station where I could hear all these people. And when Mario Lanza would sing a song, I would press my back up against the speakers because his voice used to resonate
on
my back and shake me up. And somebody said, that was probably your first sexual experience.
You and Mario Lanza.
Yeah, me and Mario Lanza vibrating my backbone. It was just, But I just didn't know. I didn't, you know, kids today, from the time they're born, know all these singers. They watch all those shows.
Yeah.
I only knew a little bit from the movies. I didn't even.
Now, what did you study at Northwestern University?
I got a Bachelor of Music degree. You know, I went in and, I mean, I was majoring in my voice, but I thought I was a pretty good pianist, but they informed me that I played with all nuance and no technique. So they started me all over again. But I, you know, it was great that I could play the piano, but I majored in voice. But I had to take conducting and orchestration and, you know, all those. But then I started, you know, I got my first serious job where I got my Equity card was when I was in college at a Highland Park Music Theater outside of Chicago. And that was a big turning point for me.
What was the show that you got your Equity card on?
The first show we did was South Pacific.
Oh, nice.
And were you Nelly?
Again, I had I was in the chorus. I was 16.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Yeah, that would have been
I guess
something.
I was called JB, Jailbait, because I was two seasons. Because I started school early, so I was underage. But again, at school, you know, I had another teacher who just, she entered me in every contest. I sang excerpts from Carmen with the Chicago Symphony. I won that.
Wow.
You know, and there, nobody recorded anything in those days. I just I did Carmen at school, the big opera, my last year, and I thought, what a shame.
Yeah.
Boy, because I would give anything to see that.
Well, I bet you were brilliant.
Yeah.
Had you ever been to New York by this time to see any shows or anything like that, even as a teenager?
Yes, I went, and I can't remember when. I think it was. You would probably know the year, because I went and stayed with a friend. I remember seeing My Fair Lady, and saw Shirley MacLaine because she was sort of a friend. She had just started in. I think Pajama King. I mean, I've got to look myself.
Yeah, so like 56 or so?
56, 57, yeah.
When was Pajama King? Is that 56, 57?
Yeah, 56, right. Yeah.
And did you see Julie Andrews in My Fair Lady?
No, her understudy was in.
Oh.
But what shocked me was, after having only seen movies, and of course I was sitting way up in a balcony, I thought, oh, the floor's so dirty. You know, it wasn't like the movies where they danced on these glass floors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's all glossy.
Everything was so sleek and beautiful. I was kind of stunned by that. And then I do remember someone taking just me to see, you know, Bells Are Ringing. Now, what year was that?
That would have been around the
56, I want to say, yeah.
Well, then it must have been at that. But I'm going to say that's when it was. I was in New York. And I.
Wow.
I remember we had tickets. A friend took me, who I'd worked with at the Highland Park Music Theater, and he knew Sidney Chaplin, who was in it. And, the standby. So we went to get coffee, and when we were waiting, he said, "There's Judy Holliday." And I looked over, and there was this little lady with a babushka on. I mean, a real, like, old-fashioned scarf tied around her head and dark glasses. And I was so stunned because she had black suede wedgies on with orange socks and a big old overcoat. And I said, "That's the star of the show?" And I was really horrified. And when she came out on stage, I gasped. She was so adorable. I couldn't, and so wonderful. I couldn't believe that weird little person that I'd seen in the drugstore. I was getting coffee because I was just so enchanted with her. She was so adorable.
Oh, yeah.
I was saying, for those of us who never got a chance to see Judy Holliday live, what made her so special?
One, she was so darling to look at, you know, with the dimples and the smile and the eyes and the short curly hair. And she was very unique. I mean, like Bernadette Peters is very unique. She happened to be very unique with the voice, with the look, but she had such a reality about her, truthfulness about her with all of that going on. And she was funny, you know, just deliciously funny. And I hadn't seen anybody. She was the first one I saw that was funny, you know, as a leading lady, you know, that was, you know, because in the movies, they were either a true leading lady or they were a character actress. Mm. You know, you didn't see that combination of humor, and yet could, you know, her voice was not, she was not known as a glorious singer, but, you know, she sure knew how to do a song. I just loved her.
Did you go to New York immediately after college? Did you graduate and then go right to New York?
I had a job, and I think I missed my graduation. I had a job at the Cohasset Music Theater. So I went right there, and we were doing Can Can, and that was a theater in the round. Have you ever been to Cohasset?
No.
No, it's big. It's still going, but they do concerts mostly now. But one day in rehearsal, and this was like within the first 2 weeks, the girl in front of me went tearing down the aisle and tripped, and I really tripped over her, and then about five people fell on me, and I really hurt myself. And I continued in the show. I even opened it up, but then I reached a point where I couldn't walk. I couldn't sit, and I couldn't walk.
Oh, my God.
I was dating someone then who became my first husband, but he came up to see me, and finally, he took me to a specialist because the theater doctor kept saying, "Oh, you've pulled a ligament. Just lie down for a minute." But he took me to a specialist. He said, "Oh, my darling, you have to go home. I had cracked my spine and herniated a couple of discs." I mean, I
was. Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
He, in agony. And so I went home. And at that point, they didn't do back operations very often. And the doctor just said to my parents, if you'll take care of her, I don't want it. We don't want to even try anything with her, you know, because she's, they said I was so young that they thought if I really stayed still, I would heal. So I laid down for about 9-10 months and gradually did some therapy and wore back braces and then went to New York.
Wow. So 10 months.
That was just crushing for me. I remember just sobbing. You know, I thought my life was over. And my mother, I mean, my parents dragged the mattress and put it on the living room floor so I could watch TV. Oh. You know, my mother would vacuum around me every day. I couldn't sit up. I would roll over to on my side to eat. you know, I'd have to crawl to the bathroom, and it was really, really a hard time for someone gung-ho, you know, ready to hit the excitement of New York. But I got there. And I had money from insurance from the fall, so I even had a little pot of money.
Wow.
You know, and I moved in with two girlfriends from Northwestern. We lived in a one-room apartment.
Do you remember where you were living?
Yes, it was on 69th Street, right off Central Park. Lincoln Center was just being built.
Oh.
And the apartment, I have to say, was a big apartment. It was a big studio apartment. There's a big kitchen and a very big bathroom. But we lived there together, and then the landlord gave us an apartment across the street that had a bedroom. And there were always people all over the floor because they were studying acting with Strasberg, and they were always working on scenes. I mean, it was quite the thing. I thought it was just absolutely fascinating and thrilling.
Were you training when you were in the city, or were you purely auditioning?
I finally found a singing teacher, and I took an opera workshop class with one of the men from the Chicago Symphony, and then you know, I was reading the trades, and then I had a friend named Regina Dombeck, who was a sorority sister and from Chicago, and she was doing very well in New York as a model and weather girl and doing commercials. And I tagged along with her one day to her commercial agents. And I was sitting outside waiting for her, reading the trades, and she, Mort Schwartz was his name, the agent. And he said, "What are you reading?" And I said, "Oh, God, there's this audition for The Boyfriend." I said, "But I don't have an agent." And he said, "I'll call." He wasn't really a theatrical agent, but he called, and he got me an audition, and I remember I found a pianist who worked on West 84th Street, and at that time, 84th, 85th were, and this is right off Central Park, for like those two blocks were the worst streets in New York. So to go there was, you were taking your life in your hands.
Wow.
So my friends told me, they said, "When you get off the subway or the bus and you walk to his apartment, act like you are crazy. You know, talk to yourself and scream every now and then." So I did. You know, I jumped up and down until I got to his apartment, and we rehearsed our number, which I sang. I even remember what I auditioned with. I sang "All I Do Is Dream of You" the whole day through. Do you know that song?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, from most famous from Singing in the Rain. Yeah.
So I sang it slowly. That was my audition. I sang it slow with my English accent, and then I did it as fast as I could, dancing every moment during the Charleston. And they all sat there kind of stunned, but I got the job. The Boyfriend was running off Broadway then, and it was a huge hit. So I learned it with the cast and went in for a minute, and then I did a road tour.
Nancy, was that your, like, first New York audition, and you booked it?
I really have to look chronologically, because I'm not sure if that was my very first job. I did a couple of weird off-Broadway things, one called Dr. Willy Nilly. I do remember that title.
Ooh, Dr. Willy Nilly?
Yes, and I'm trying to remember who was involved with that. I think Alfred Drake was involved with that.
Oh, wow.
I have to look it up. I know I have a program somewhere. I may have to, we all may have to look it up. But I did. I usually got any job I went up on. And I, you know, then I did Julius Monk's Upstairs at the Downstairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we wanted to talk about that. Was that called Four Below Strikes Back?
Yes, yes.
So for our listeners who don't know, who was Julius Monk?
Oh, my God, he was such a character. I mean, this club was so beautiful, and it was so chic. And to be in one of these shows was just a living in. I mean, and I must say, they had all the good writers, like Holman, all these people used to write stuff for his reviews. He was from the South, Julius. He was very tall, slim, the white hair, and everyone thought he was English. You know, a lot of Southerners sound English. You know, oh, my darling, you're so wonderful, you're splendid. You know, I auditioned him in his kitchen. He just dragged me in the kitchen and said, sing something. you know, and I did, and they weren't ready to mount the show yet, so he said, just do a little act here. I don't know, and I don't remember at all what I did. Sang a few songs every night. But I had been there because Mabel Mercer had been in that room, and my husband thought I should hear Mabel Mercer. So,
do you remember some of the material you did in Four Below Strikes Back?
I know I did a skit called about a film thing, and where I had to keep saying my father is a deviant, and I know when my father came. He did come to see the show. And then I sang a song, What a Wonderful Day to Be 17. I sang a song about Charlie Chan, which is really cute. I almost dragged that sucker out.
Maybe we'll see it in the cabaret.
Yeah. We did fun things, you know. It was... that is the best training of all. That's why I think some of our best performers now come from Second City. All those things where you do all the different crazy stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the off-Broadway show, the versions plus this one. You know, you were free to offer, you know, other lines or your opinion or your whatever you want, or try things. You know, you were encouraged to experiment. So it was. It was a real good training ground. But from the Four Below Strikes Back is where I then got the audition for Do-Re-Mi. But meanwhile, I'm trying to see again. I've lost the sequence of my working.
I also
was with the New York City Opera for two or three years.
Yeah. You did Carrie, I believe, in Carousel, but I think you did that in the mid-60s after.
That was part of Gene Dalrymple's. And what I was going to ask Karen, because I can't remember. I didn't know if they did three shows in the spring and then three shows in the fall. I don't know if they did that many. But it was at City Center, and it was a big-time job. It was just a great job to have. But the opera company was separate. I was literally with the New York City Opera doing lighter things. Like, I did Street Scene and the Mikado, and they kept... Julius Rudell was the conductor, and he kept bringing me in like every 6 months to sing for him.
Oh!
And the last time I came in and sang, who knows what, some little aria, he said, I'm ready to bump you up.
Oh!
Like, bigger parts, more legit opera, and I went, oh no, I'm leaving.
I want to
do musical theater. I want to do musical theater, and he was quite disgusted.
I was going to say, who do you influence on you as a mentor?
Besides a couple of teachers, and I would say my teacher in New York, Keith Davis, who at one point taught everyone, anyone who was on Broadway, he was their teacher. My teacher at school, and then, you know who was... as good to me as anybody could ever be was Phil Silvers. Phil Silvers and Nancy Walker in that first show. They both kind of took me under their wing and they taught me so much. They were really quite incredible, especially Phil, because he's the one I had the most to do with on stage. And about a year or so ago, I ran into a couple of his grandchildren at some function, you know, and I grabbed them and just said, I want you to know. You need to know how great he was and how generous he was. And he liked me because I didn't know all his stories, and like a lot of very funny men, he had a very sad side to him.
Yeah.
You know, and I would listen to all his stories, all his showbiz stories, his ramblings about things, and I just loved him. I loved him to death. He just, I mean, like our opening night of Glory, I mean, that first song I sang, you know, Cry Like the Wind, he just grabbed a chair, turned it around so his back was to the audience and said, "Sing it, kid, you know, let me hear this song." But he would always say something under his breath, "Let him have it, you know, you're the best, crazy for you, whatever." And I was way downstage. I was very, very close to him and the audience, so I was always a little nervous. But he just, and when I was on stage doing something, I remember one day at rehearsal, I had a tendency, because most of my experience on the stage had been in the round. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, I was gradually learning how to do proscenium, but I used to kind of upstage him because I would usually hang behind him, which I thought was out of respect.
Yeah.
One day he just put his arm around me and brought me down. He said, "You deserve to be right here with me. You deserve to be right downstage, right in the front of everybody." I mean, he would say that kind of a thing.
Wow.
And, you know, he taught me how to listen, to really listen on stage and how to, I mean, he really kind of freed me up in another way. And he was so good. I couldn't get over how his energy and his every instinct was right, and he sang great. You know, he was so musical.
Yeah.
And he made me laugh one day. He said, "You know, the writers are waiting for me to ad lib." He said, "I'm not going to give them one line till I've squeezed them dry." They knew the show wasn't working totally out of town, you know, but he was great. And Nancy and I became close friends, which people couldn't believe that, because she always had a reputation as being kind of difficult. She used to tease me. She said, "Good God, I'm in love with an ingenue. Who thought I would ever like an ingenue?"
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
But those early years were, you know, and Julie Stein, I mean, they all were so generous to me. And Julie, you know, he would ask me all the time, "Do you like this song? Because I'll write you another one." The first song he wrote for me, Before Cry Like the Wind, I didn't like. And I told him, I actually didn't like the way I sang it. I thought it was really too difficult. I didn't think it sounded like a folk. It was supposed to sound like a folk song. And so he, you know, he kept saying, "I want you and John Reardon," he said, "I want you to blow their heads off when you sing. I'll keep writing till, you know, I give you songs that make the audience, you know, just go crazy." And they did. I mean, you know, you don't run into, writers don't think that way anymore.
No,
and
I
didn't know that Julie had also been a voice teacher, voice coach. So he knew the voice, you know. He also, and his first concern was, you know, for the singer. So he did well by us. He really
Boy, that's
well
special. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And you know, I'm sorry that I, as the years went on, that I didn't stay closer to him, because he's still one of my most favorites ever. This crazy little man who was such a brilliant writer. I mean, Phil Silver said, so cocky, he was so successful so early, he said, he used to go to his publishers in the Brill Building and just open the door and throw them on the floor. "Here's another one. You know, here's another kid." And walk out. So I'm really happy that I got there early enough to experience the Brill Building and these writers. I made a list before I did this recent act. I made a list of all the composers I had known and worked with. And I was stunned because it's really quite a group. I must say.
Yeah.
And then you received a Tony Award nomination for Do Re Mi.
Yes, I did.
The first of two, I believe.
Fun thing about that was, at that time, I mean, I truly was a secondary player. You know, I was not the star of the show. But also in my category was Tammy Grimes and Cheetah Rivera. But they weren't in the star category because their name was not above the title. Your name had to be above the title.
Oh.
So all well, these, and then years later when I was nominated for Tony for Bajur, and I had a pretty good shot at it, at getting the Tony, but the day before the announcement came out, Al Prince put Liza's name above the title so that she could compete in the starring role.
Oh.
I went, oops, there it goes.
Now,
that was awkward because, you know, of course, in Bajur, I was working with Cheetah. And, she was not nominated, but by God, we got dolled up and we went through the ceremony together.
Yeah, you did.
And we, I tell this in my act too. I said, the Tonys at that point were held in some hotel room or something, a ballroom. And I knew I was in trouble because our table straddled two rooms. I mean, we weren't even in the main room, really. So we knew. My chances were slim. But boy, we were dolled up. We had our phony hair pieces on and our eyelashes and our phony fingernails. That era. And we had a ball. And she and I became really close friends, and we still are. So that made up for any disappointment, you know, for that. Hey, where are we?
Here we go, Nancy. I'm about to ask you about one of my favorite musicals, which is Bajur.
I listened to that album not too long ago. That is a really good album.
It is a great album.
Yeah, it is.
I'm going to say it is a great album. We really love it, and we have a lot of students and a lot of our audience that loves it even more than we do, if that's possible. So.
You have to come see this act because I'm actually doing the entire Where is the Tribe for Me.
Okay.
Yes! Yes!
So
I did, when I sang at the Russian tea room a couple of times, and I did like 8 bars, and then the next time I came, I would sing 12 bars, and then the next time it would be, 20 bars. But I started going over it with my pianist, and he just said, you have to do this whole thing. The best songs ever. I haven't sung this song in 50 years all the way through. So get ready.
I cannot wait. So I have to ask you about this song. Were you able to do all of those noises and they discovered that and they wrote the song around that, or did you learn how to make all those sounds? How did this go?
That was the song, and it originally was longer. I had to, I don't remember what I auditioned with when I originally auditioned for the show, but then they gave me this song, and I laughed because my pianist was a man named Dick DeBenedictis, who was a stunning pianist who later became a very famous television composer.
I know Dick.
Do you know Dick?
Yeah, yeah.
But wow. He had a broken arm. He played this audition, and the song was about 10 minutes long, originally. Still long. I think it's 8 minutes. I think it's 7 minutes or something long. And I laughed because, he was just playing away, but you'd hear his, you'd hear him clunk, clunk on the piano, because, his arm was all braced up, and he actually got the job that day as the dance arranger.
Yeah.
So, even beat me getting the job. I wish I could remember who was up for it beside me. I just don't remember.
I think somebody had mentioned,
A school contacted me because they wanted to do the show, and I always say the original script was a really good script. It needed some work, but what happened was, Cheetah was the star, and it turned out that my role was the better role. So. Once they got out of town, they, in trying to make it better for her, it got messed up a bit. It got messed up a bit, and they never could then get it right. At one point, our champion was going to come in because he felt that he could really pull the show together. And he was, you know, and he loved Cheetah so much, but it meant firing the director, the choreographer, a couple of cast members, two cast members, I remember, and they just, the producers backed out. But
fascinating. Fascinating.
I should ask Cheetah. I couldn't find the original script. I only had a later one, and I'm really sorry that I couldn't find it, that I didn't keep it. You know, it didn't occur to me at the time. We were so busy.
Sure.
You know, there were so many rewrites and trying to keep track of what was. It was a hard show. It was a hard show, and I got sick. I don't know if you... I got very ill when we were on the road.
Oh, really? I did not know this.
I've never been sick. I mean, where it affected my voice, I'd never had that happen. So psychologically, I went into a spin. And when we got, and I think I missed one night on the road, and I was going to say a terrible understudy. She just wasn't good. She wasn't very good at all. I mean, and God forbid they should get someone who could have really done it. They did. And then when I came into New York, I went to my own doctor, and he said, oh, my God, they've misdiagnosed you. They've missed everything. And I was put on all these drugs. And he kept saying to me, and at that time when we came into New York, we started doing previews. We didn't have a day off. We did previews, show open, show, and then the recording. So, and you know, my doctor kept saying, if you can get one matinee off, just one day where you don't have to do so much, he said, I think you can, you know, rise above it. But I started losing weight. I mean, it was just a nightmare for me. And I stayed doing the show, and I, you know, got good reviews, but I finally got so, and I think it was mostly psychological. I got so ill, I passed out once in the middle of the show. And
oh, my goodness.
So I finally got out, and at that point, they were allowed by the rules, equity rules and everything, to send me to a doctor of their choice. So I went to a doctor of their choice, and, you know, I came in his office, and he was a German man. You know, my speaking voice was husky, everything was, and he said, oh, my darling, you're in such trouble. And then he recorded me, and I sounded fine. It was like the voice sounded like it was okay. He said, no wonder they don't think you're sick, because for some reason, you know, your voice sounds very clear. But I couldn't hit certain notes, and it just wasn't strong, and like I said, I was such a mess. And what they did, the other thing they did during the previews, when they knew I was having a little trouble, and when they knew I wanted to take a day off, or I wanted to, you know, 2 days off, whatever, they would always make sure someone was in the audience that I could see. It was close enough, you know, to the stage, like Florence Henderson. They'd always have somebody sitting there that could have replaced me. They did that. They did that also. They were really stinkos.
Oh man!
And I wasn't strong enough to say, you know what, or just not come one night. You know, I could have just called in and said, you know, I can't make it tonight, and put on the understudy, because they would not have had time to replace me. Really, you know, I wasn't thinking straight, and obviously my agent wasn't thinking at all. So, I finally did get up. But that same doctor, their doctor, gave me some medicine, and he said, you take these pills, and you'll be fine. And you give your notice, and it'll be good. Well, the pills had me singing like a lark, so I didn't give my notice.
Mm.
And when I came back to him, he was horrified, because he said, you know, I can't give you any more. There's steroids. I mean, they were very strong steroids. So, but I eventually got out, and I stayed out for a month. That was the only way they could find a replacement. And, she was the star of Little Me.
Nancy...
No, the younger Belle, or whatever.
Oh, the young,
blonde, had a big old voice, and she wouldn't...
Virginia Martin.
Yeah, Virginia Martin. I didn't have to stay out for a month. to get well, but she demanded that she get at least a month, you know, in order to take over the part. So she did, and then I came back when I finished the run. But that was so traumatic for me, that whole experience, that I didn't sing for years. I didn't sing for 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
And so then, Nancy, by the end of the 60s, you've played just about every single great role in musical theater. You've done Nellie, you've done Carrie, you've done Sharon and Finian's. Are there any roles that are still on your bucket list, or any roles you, boy, go, I wish I got my hands on that one?
Well, the one I haven't done, and I don't know if I could do it physically, is Sweeney Todd. I sang with the Pittsburgh Symphony a Sondheim evening. It was, oh God, what a glorious job that was. I think they had 60, 70 pieces in the symphony that night. It was an all Sondheim concert. And it was with me and George Hearn and like three other singers. So we did that huge hunk of Sweeney Todd. And I mean, Karen's done the role, and I said, Jesus, did I have to work on that sucker? I think I spent a month working on that scene.
Mm.
And George Hearn, who is the best I've ever, he's just the best. Again, he's one of those really generous performers, because he just done it at the Philharmonic in New York with Patti LuPone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did that in concert. And I asked him, I said, please, please, don't hesitate to give me any little suggestion or nuance. And he was so darling, he said, I don't have to tell you anything. Just go. But he was so good to work with, you know. He's one of those that you just get better and better, mm-hmm. because he's damn good. And it was a thrill. I mean, but I never got to do the whole show, you know, so.
Well, I think you could still do it.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe. But I'm glad I at least got that, you know.
Yeah.
I got to do that with him. That made me real, real happy, especially with such a big, fat orchestra.
Oh, yeah.
And so the...
Again, that was at City Center. I did two things. That was the best production of Carousel. That was as good as any production, I think, ever.
Really?
Connie Towers was Julie and...
Oh, yeah.
His name just went out of my head. He was so... And I was Carrie, and Jack DeLon played my boyfriend. He was a little plump. He was a wonderful character actor with a tenor voice that soared to the heavens. You know, when I sang about Mr. Snow and he walked out, the audience just went crazy. I've got some pictures from that. It was just a beautiful production. The other thing I did for City Center was they did a production of Fiorello that we took to the White House.
Oh, wow.
Really?
And Lyndon Johnson was the president then, and there were so many people who said, oh, you can't go there, you know, because they really disliked him. And I said, oh, no, no, no. Don't you see? That's when you have to go. You have to go see what really goes on. And they were wonderful to me. Mrs. Johnson invited my parents to come, but they got too nervous. They wouldn't come. They wouldn't come. But they wanted to cut the number, the bum one. And this was a meeting of all the governors and the senators in Washington at that time. So that's who it was going to be at this big function. Right? So I said, you can't cut, of all the songs in the show, because my family was still living, you know, right outside of Washington, I said, you can't cut that number. And of course, it brought the house down.
Yeah, of course.
More so than any other song. And that was a thrill. You know, that was just the perfect show to do there. So that was great. That was great.
So, I mean, you've had so many great roles. This is incredible.
It is. And, you know, working on this act, My Life Upon the Wicked Stage, was really difficult to weed out songs and five songs, you know, figure out what I really wanted to sing. And I asked my musical director, his name is Christopher Marlowe, and he's just stupendous. Did he like putting together medleys? And he just kind of stared at me. But we, together, along with my husband, who is a director, he helped us put this thing together. You know, I make cards, you know, they're index cards, of about 100 songs, and then we wheedled them down. But it is about 9 minutes long, 19-minute medley. And it really turned out great.
Oh, right.
I cannot wait to hear it.
Wait, she said, I started to cry during that medley. She said, it's every frigging great song you could think of. And she said, and I did so many of those roles, too. So anyone in the business got very sentimental about it all.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. It was. It was a perfect reaction. And because I didn't know if it would hold, you know. I even said at the beginning of the act, even if you don't know who I am or whatever, I said, you know, this is all about the music and the men and women who wrote it. That's,
yeah.
You know, I wanted to take it off of me, you know, me.
I think it's a smart idea.
It turned out to be about that, which was very satisfying. So
I cannot wait to listen to it.
Oh, well, you're wonderful. I'll come get you if you don't come. I'll just...
we'll be there.
We'll be there with bells on, probably we'll singing there along with you. So then
you can find Walter Marks, because you know, after revisiting the show and I listening to the album again, because I was trying to listen to everything I'd ever done, I thought, God, he was such a clever, wonderful writer. And I know he's done a couple of things since, but I thought, what a shame. That show was such a disappointment because it never achieved what it should have. So I would like to see if I could find him. See if he could come.
That would be great. I mean, I think it's time for us to reexamine and reinvestigate that show and that score, because I really do think it's fantastic. I just don't think it's gotten the credits deserved yet. In the 1970s and early 80s, you do a lot of television work, a lot of film and TV work. Did you always know that you were going to be going on to film and television work, or did that come as a surprise to you?
Oh, what was interesting, I did a play down at the Public when Joe Papp was running it. You know, I did a play called Trelawney of the Wells,
mm-hmm.
which just got stupendous reviews, but it was the newspaper strike, so it didn't run as long as it should have, and that was a big thing for me. And at that moment, my manager said, if you don't come out to California, he said, I won't be able to book you anymore in the summer or anywhere if you don't get on television. And I lucked out, and Joe Papp was so mad that I left New York to go there, but I did, and I lucked out because I got a series. And then, because of that series, you know, my husband and I would... We would mount a show every summer that I could tour in, because I'm getting my act together a lot and things like that. So he was right, you know. But he said, if you're not on television, they're not that interested.
You know? That's fascinating. So you had to have a large TV presence before you could start doing a lot of the summer stock and a lot of the regional theaters.
I mean, I had done some to be able to continue. John Kinley, a man who had owned three theaters in the Midwest, was the first one to start that, hire TV stars for his summer theaters, and then it proved to be really successful. And it still is. No, that's who's on Broadway. Half the people on Broadway are, not that they are incapable of doing that job either, but they become famous because of television.
Yep. Did you enjoy going on the road?
I did. Especially later, because, you know, when I was married to my first husband, I never went on the road, except I had to do Do-Re-Mi because it was in my contract.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that. Another fun thing is I didn't mention was when I went into Side by Side by Sondheim, the first time and only time I ever did that, I put it in my contract that I got to sing Send in the Clowns. Because that was the only song I knew when I was.
I have to say, and we'll show this to our listeners, but there's a beautiful clip of you singing "Send in the Clowns" on YouTube.
There is.
Yeah, I watched it last night.
Really? I've never seen anything "Send in the Clowns," and it was funny because they hired Georgia Brown after me. They initially offered the show to me and Karen, because Karen and I had been doing our. We've been doing, you know...
Your TV show.
And she could not do it because she had just done a pilot.
Ah.
And couldn't get out of it. She had to wait and see if the pilot sold. So So they brought in Georgia Brown, and I, at one point Hal Prince said, you know, Georgia would really, it, that would be a really good song for her. And I just said, yeah, it would.
You.
I want to sing it. And, you know, and Georgia was, she again was a wonderful dame. She just was great. She said, oh, honey, I don't care. I'll find something, you know, something else. So.
I love that.
But I have her online is from Side by Side, which I was so glad. I don't have a video of it, but it's a singing a song called The Two of Us that Sondheim had written for Kukla, Fran, and Ollie.
Yes.
That they had never done. And then when Bert Tilstrom took over as the narrator at the, for the last few months of Side by Side on Broadway, they put the song in then.
Mm.
And some the nice man sent me a copy of the music because I didn't even have a copy of the music. You know, somebody had the soundtrack of it, and it's amazing what people have.
Yes.
Oh, it is.
And shocking.
I will send you the clip of you singing Send in the Clowns. I will do that tonight so you can take a look at yourself. And then not a lot of people know this. You were the first anchor of Good Morning America. Is that correct?
That is correct. And that came out of the blue. It was funny because I was in California just for a while, and I had gotten like three phone calls from, let me hope I remember his name, it will come to me, a producer that I knew, and I thought, oh God, he's asking me to do another benefit. And so I didn't return phone calls for days. And finally I went, Nancy, yes, I do talk to myself. Being more professional, so I called him back, and he told me about the show, and he wanted me to come in and meet Leonard Goldenson, and I said, why did you even think of me? I mean, why did, they'd already hired David Hartman. I said, this is out of the blue, and he said, well, I've seen you on the Merv Griffin and the talk shows, and the fact was I had done very few of them, and I didn't frankly think I was that good. But anyway, I went in and met Leonard Goldenson, and he told me all about it. And then they took me into a studio like the next day, and David interviewed me, and then I did weather reports and I read commercials and did all this thing. And you know, we started in like a week.
Wow.
About being unprepared for a job, Jesus. And they were going to start live immediately, but they couldn't. The crew, nobody was quite ready to do that, so. But that was a tough job because I didn't know what I was doing. but God knows I loved it. I just met everybody in the world. I mean, talk about a wonderful job, you know, but it was hard for me being a Broadway lady to get up at 3 or 4 in the morning or 5.
Oh, no.
Because, like, the day of the Macy's parade, I had to get up at 3 to go watch them blow up the balloons.
Tell us very quickly, though, about your involvement at UCLA in their musical theater program.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
I was a student of a very, very good friend of Nancy Walker's husband, David Craig.
Mm-hmm.
He was very good friends with a man named Mel Shapiro, who was head of the department at UCLA. And they were left money by Ray Bolger's estate to start a music theater program. So I was recommended. So it was just me and a choreographer who started the program. And my first class was with the MFAs, which was great fun. And I stayed for about five and a half years, and that was, and then that kind of, then money-wise, and I had Karen hired and some other people hired. Money became an issue for them, so they let us go. Cheaper
wow.
to job in people by the quarter. It was easier for them to do that. But at least I did it for a while, and it started.
And passed on all your knowledge to the next generation of artists. Nancy, I cannot even...
Teaching. I still teach and do private coaching. And my husband and I both taught every summer for like 12 summers with the Broadway Theater Project down in Florida. And then the Performing Arts Project, which is in North Carolina. So now we just kind of do it every now and then. If someone needs some help, you know, we do that. So that's good. It's all good.
Yeah. That's great.
Nancy, I cannot even begin to tell you how much we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Mm-hmm. And there's more. We know there's more.
Oh, there's so much more.
It was a real pleasure to talk with you both, and I'm flattered that you are so interested. So, thank you.
Well, we are honored, and we cannot wait to see you at 54 Below.
Tune in next week for orchestrator Larry Moore.
Where is the tribe for me? We're living in some primitive stage. Is that unstudied breed who've somehow managed coming of age unhelped by Margaret Mead? Where is my ethnic group? Where are those savage pre-Adamites who live unseen, unknown, waiting to show me puberty rights that I can call my own? You're not an entomologist until you get the word. You're not an ornithologist until you get the bird. Like some unfrocked theologist, I haven't got a prayer. I'm not an anthropologist until I write a diatribe on why a tribe is there. But where can they be at? Where's their natural habitat? Where they still roam free? Anthropologically, tell me where is the tribe for? Sometimes I see myself searching through the jungle dark and deep, on safari, searching for my tribe, through the wild birds, and the poison darts, and the jungle cats, and the tsetse flies. Food gone, water gone, all the guides have run away, and the drums, searching for my tribe, through the boa constrictors, and the gorillas, aha, and the quicksand, and the tsetse flies. Onward through the area, burning with malaria, alone in my safari, and there's no one to be sorry if I rot with dry rot. But wait, wait. Look there, through the giant bushwood trees, grass huts, cooking fires. Can it be my tribe? Now they're coming, strangely painted savages, and at last I've found them. Here is the tribe for me. No more laughing hyenas, hee hee hee. No more stampeding elephants, ooh, ooh. No more drums, bubble away. No more tss, ah, 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 ah. Tsetse flies. Oh, yes, here is my tribe. And now they come to greet me, crying, Buona, Buona. Well, yes, I wanna tribe. And they take me to meet their chief. And I enter a large hut, and I hear the strange music of... Oh, no, it can't be, it's... Albert, you've beat me to it again. Albert, tell me, please, where is the tribe for me? One that has not heard of NYU, DAR, or LBJ. People who bear no allegiance to CIO or CIA. Oh, please, I'm on bended knees. Meant to be my PhD. Tell me where is the tribe for me?
Tune in next week for orchestrator Larry Moore.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit. that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.